name's Damon Goff, and for BBC Radio 2, I'm stepping back in time to the one concert I would have given anything to be at. Bruce Springsteen at Hammersmith Odeon, 1975. Listen to that. That's one of the best versions of one of the greatest songs at one of rock's most legendary concerts. Well, for me it is anyway. At that moment, on November 18th, 1975, at the Hammersmith Odeon, it was just Bruce, the piano, and Thunder Road.
Screen door slams, Mary's dress waves.
Over 3,000 fans were lucky enough to have seen Bruce Springsteen play his first ever UK gig that evening. But sadly, I wasn't one of them. I wish I could have been there, but while the man who would later change my life was about to go on stage, I was 150 miles away, no doubt settling down to my tea in Bolton. And besides, at 6 years old, it's unlikely my mum would have let me out of the house.
Changed my life.
Yeah?
That night changed my life, yeah, absolutely, Jeff. Because from then on, I started expecting something different from music. So you're
scared and you're thinking that... I'm stood underneath the Hammersmith flyover looking at what's now called the Hammersmith Apollo. In 75 it was known as the Hammersmith Odeon, where famously Bruce Springsteen made his debut UK appearance, 25-year-old kid from New Jersey, and arrived to see billboards announcing him as the next biggest thing. The world's ready finally to see Bruce Springsteen. I'm trying to imagine really how he must have felt coming all this way, greeted with that hype. I'd imagine it was a mixture of emotions, really, like excitement and disgust, because he was just trying to do his thing. Well, now I'm no hero that's understood. All the
redemption I can offer girls beneath this dirty hood. There's no question that an awful lot of people have written an awful lot of rubbish about that night. I think an awful lot of people that wrote about it couldn't have been there, because in our company, he was an awful lot of fun.
One spotlight on the piano, that fantastic opening chords to Thunder Road. Spotlight on a man in the middle, harmonica, screen door slaps, just like, phenomenal.
That song, Thunder Road, that's one of the reasons I became a songwriter. The version at Hammersmith is played with such a confidence, as if Bruce is just saying, this is me, upset me if you will. To understand Hammersmith, I need to rewind to a few months before the concert. Dave Marsh, one of rock's all-time great journalists, has documented Bruce's life and career since the early days. Dave's 1979 biography on Bruce, Born to Run, was my Bible as a teenage Bruce fan, and I felt honoured and a little bit nervous to be talking with him.
I saw him for the first time in 73 at Max's. I started out to go review Bob Marley and the Wailers, and the opening act turned out to be Bruce, in a club that seated maybe 150, 200 people. And Bruce just, he was captivating. With the first show that John Landau and I saw up in Boston, in that little bar called Charlie's, that was so good it was scary.
Around that time then, when they were on the cusp of going to Europe for the first time, particularly going to the Hammersmith first London show, did you think Bruce was onto something? Did you think it was a pivotal point at all? Did you think anything about that show? Did you worry for him? Or what were your thoughts, apart from not being able to go?
I thought at that point that he was the pivotal figure in rock and roll history. That's exactly what I thought, which made a lot of people very angry. And they took it out on him as much as me. But I thought it, and I said so, and I still think it. And I think it's more and more obvious that that was true.
That faith in one man, plus the hype generated by Bruce's record company, led to two of America's biggest news magazines running front cover stories on Bruce in the same week, not long before the Hammersmith concert. Time magazine talked about the regeneration and renewal of rock and roll. Newsweek questioned whether a guy few people had heard of really was the next Dylan. And then there was John Landau, the rock journalist who became Bruce's manager, who famously wrote that he had seen rock and roll's future.
So, I mean, the people who were claiming great things about Bruce were people like Mick Watts, who was the melody maker. The Melody Maker was the biggest of the weeklies then. And Mick was living in New York, and you know, he was seeing it. And, of course, the skepticism was enormous. Rock and roll had become a British thing. And I think the pressure in Britain was to not like it.
Rightly or wrongly, that quote, along with the enormous hype that was happening in the US, meant that by the time Bruce arrived in London, the British critics were gleefully sharpening their knives, ready to destroy rock and roll's future. And then, of course, there were the words,
Finally, London is ready for Bruce Springsteen, plastered on every free bit of wall at Hammersmith and placed on every seat in the house. Legend has it that in an uncharacteristic rage, Bruce tore down the posters.
Okay, we're now backstage at the Hammersmith Apollo, as it was in 75, the Hammersmith Odeon. Just walking up the steps to the dressing room that would have been the one Bruce would have used on the night. I'm going to meet the former assistant editor of the Melody Maker at the time, who'd spent a bit of time with Bruce and was probably in this dressing room that very night. Let's see if he's here. Hello. You must be Michael?
I am, yes, hi, nice to see you.
Right.
Journalist Michael Watts was one of Bruce's early champions. He, along with John Landau and Dave Marsh, called him the saviour of rock and roll. Over in Britain, Bruce was caught up in the war between NME and the Melody Maker.
So Michael, we're here in this dressing room, which we think was the one Bruce used on the night in 75, what was your reason for being asked backstage?
Well, at that point I was deputy editor at Melody Maker. But also, I'd known Bruce from when I lived in America, working for the same paper. And in fact, I spent about a month travelling across Texas with him. And then I, in 75, came back to live again in Britain. So I was obviously here when he played Hammersmith Odeon on November 18th, 1975. It was the year in which he broke through from being a cult artist. It was the month before he appeared here at the Hammersmith Odeon. He'd made the covers of both Time and Newsweek. He'd made Born to Run, which was getting a lot of airplay and becoming a great success. Beyond the palace, heavy power drones scream down the boulevard. The girls comb their hairs and rearview mirrors and the first time looks so hard. I think 75 was also the year in which his two first albums, which had only been cult successes, finally made the American top 60. So he really was a cult figure until this particular year. So he came to Britain on a rising tide of appeal and interest and fascination. But it has to be said that for as many people who supported him and loved him, there was a lot of hostility towards him, which was really occasioned by his record company putting together this campaign. And it was a sort of conflict with the hard sell of his then record company, which coloured his whole performance at Hammersmith Odeon.
Before he'd even picked up his guitar to play Born to Run, the British critics had already decided his fate. Expectations were so high that the only way was down. Bruce's record company wanted to milk the publicity as much as possible. Michael Watts spent the day driving around London with Bruce and a journalist from the Sunday Times.
The idea was that we would sort of tour around the West End and show Bruce what London was like. I mean, he was a guy who'd come from New Jersey. And we made the mistake, I think, of taking him to Harrods. And we took him round Harrods, and the minute we stepped through the doors of Harrods, I realised this was a big mistake. Because the guy from the Sunday Times wanted him to try on a bowler hat and carry a brolly, and I could see his whole posture slumping, thinking, I hate this kind of shtick. The typical American tourist, I'm being shoehorned into that. And then, of course, in the process of driving around London, we went past the front of Hammersmith Odeon, which said in right across the front of it, almost neon lit, at last, London is ready for future of rock and roll. And his spirits really sank after that. One, two, three.
If the posters had made Bruce's spirits sink, then later on that day, perhaps a HP Source rep from Cardiff just might have helped them lift again. Pete Harris had taken a week off, packed some jars of Piccalilli to hand out to anyone who might help him realise his dream of meeting Bruce. He tracked him down to the Churchill Hotel in London's West End.
We badgered people at reception and got on people's nerves, and eventually Bruce turned up and was absolutely fantastic. We explained how far we'd travelled and that I'd taken a week off work and planned it around it. I think I think it was a good job this happened before Mark Chapman encountered John Lennon, because I'm not sure Bruce would have spent quite as much time with these two men who were clearly nuts. But it worked out great. We got on really well, and he was extremely kind and receptive to what we were talking about. And I talked about various songs of his, and he told us that there was a party after the show, and that it'd be great if we could come along. And an HP Source rep looked at a carpet rep and said, I think we'll have a bit of that.
Pete's shoes, in which he had stored his ticket to the show to keep safe in case he got too drunk, a repair I definitely would have liked to be wearing that night.
When we first met Bruce, he was scruffy. He wore the same clothes that he wore in the concert. And all that sort of stuff is pretty endearing, you know. If you've grown up enjoying Bob Dylan via Woody Guthrie, I wasn't interested in people that wore slick suits. Bruce was wearing a tea cosy on his head, and he had a scarf wrapped around his neck, and he was as scruffy as we were, really, and he just had a big smile, and he was excited by it. And there's no question that an awful lot of people have written an awful lot of rubbish about that night, because, yes, the Hammersmith Odeon was covered in banners like, you know, London is finally ready for Bruce Springsteen. And those sort of things, you know, I don't think he was wildly happy about, but it wasn't the dreadful cataclysmic nonsense that people have written about. I think an awful lot of people that wrote about it couldn't have been there, because in our company, he was an awful lot of fun.
I've been lucky enough to meet Bruce several times. I've even had the honour of Bruce dedicating a song to my son, Oscar Bruce. But on November 18th, 1975, Pete Harris was the guy all the other fans in the audience were envious of.
I remember talking to him at some length in the afternoon on the merits of a song called It's Hard to Be a Saint in the City. And at the time, I think that was my favourite song. And I remember saying to him, I hope you'll sing that. Just prior to doing It's Hard to Be a Saint in the City, he actually says,
"It's for Pete."
Even now, I still get hugely chuffed when I hear that, because it was a really big day in my life, and I thought, bearing in mind that London was finally ready for Bruce Springsteen, and every record executive in Europe was there just about to see this momentous event, he could remember to say hello to the HP Source salesman from Cardiff.
Now we're stood right in the middle of the floor. Did it have seats at the time?
Yeah.
Middle of the Hammersmith Odeon floor, looking at the stage, which seems surprisingly close considering we're halfway back in the room. And I'm here with two Bruce fans that were here on the night in 1975 to see Bruce's first UK gig, Michael and Matt.
First thing I remember is all the lights going down, buzz. Of course, it started with this guy on the piano thing.
That's right. And there was, but you couldn't see Bruce.
No. And then, of course, the spotlight in the middle of the stage hit with this little guy with scruffy looking, huge, the biggest pair of trousers I've seen in my life. Massive Green Army trousers, you know. Skinny guy with beard and his hat, playing the harmonica. And, of course, then you realise, I was surprised at how low-key the start was, because normally, especially the first London show, the guy with the hype he's got, you think he'd come in and go, wham, here I am. And it was just so low-key, a little piano, and you think, that was really weird. It was a weird start, you know, and then, of course, then he kicked in, and it was awesome.
That was just fantastic.
Yeah, strange beginning, I thought. Strange beginning.
I personally think that's the best thing about it, is the start. The confidence to walk out and just sing.
Fantastic.
But you know something? Years ago, when you went to see a live show, you pretty much expected the album version of the songs.
Yeah.
And so when he was doing Thunder Road and the band didn't come in halfway through, I thought, well, what's strange? You know, it just threw me a bit. And also the other thing was that certain songs, which I thought were just phenomenal on albums, like Spirit of the Night and stuff like that, Kitty's Back, I didn't think he'd be able to reproduce it on stage. So I was really amazed at how you know, good it sounded. The sound was crystal clear.
Yeah.
I'd never heard the sound that clear for a gig before in my life. And also, the lighting was dramatic.
One of the other reasons that I envy not being at shows in that era, because 70, something about 70s lighting, it just looked brilliant.
Yeah.
And the sound as well, it's just different. It's just, there's a quality there, something to do with the equipment that was used at the time.
Yeah, I think so. But it did look good, and it sounded great, especially the, like you say, the opening number, Thunder Road, so clear, like piano. It was very different from what you're used to seeing at that time, you know, in 75, which is a horrible period for music anyway, generally, I think. You know, the charts were full of just rubbish. And the big acts were your Pink Floyd, your Zeppelins, your Genesis, which I just wasn't into at all. So I could see this guy, you know, who had obviously had roots in the 60s and the Stax and Bauta, and that was his sort of thing, if you like, and Dylan, and, you know, that was his roots. It was, you didn't see a lot of that.
Standing here now, 30 years later, in the same room, you take yourself back, what made the hair stand on the back of your neck?
There was a buzz. There was an anticipation. I just remember sitting there. What are we going to see? What's going to happen?
I think it was more when they came on for me, because most of the stuff you saw here in 1975 and the time up to that, it looked like a lot of hippies on stage, you know, with big flare jeans and standing there, like, not moving, not doing it. And these guys come on, and like I said, they look real New York sort of street swagger about them. And it was all like smart suits and fedora hats. And they looked totally different. They just took command of this. And funny, Bruce looked like the odd one out because he had this, like, T-shirt, leather jacket, really baggy trousers. And the rest of them were just real...
sharp.
Yeah, sharp, you know, like a bunch of pimps, you know.
Which was the greatest song
for
of the night.
It would be the very beginning. Everything goes into darkness. You think, what's going on? One spotlight on the piano, that fantastic opening chords to Thunder Road. Spotlight on a man in the middle, harmonica, screen door slams. Just, like, you know, phenomenal. Yeah.
It always comes back to Thunder Road. I don't know whether to be insanely jealous or pleased that my favourite song was performed so well that night, and that it seems to be a favourite amongst a lot of fans. Former Melody Maker journalist Mick Watts amongst them.
Well, Thunder Road, I think, is his best song, isn't it?
It's the song that got me into Bruce, which is, I think, why I like it the most. It's the first one that connected with me.
It's a very romantic song, you know. It's about the romance of rock and roll. One of the great opening verses of any rock, screen door slams, Mary's dress waves. It's just a great line.
You ain't a beauty, but hey, you're alright, and that's all right.
It's a brilliant line, which you never forget, do you? Well, show a little faith, there's magic in the night. You ain't a beauty, but hey, you're alright. Oh, and that's alright with me. Over there, if you look to the left, there are two.
Were you on stage?
Two doors. No. Down, you know, just over the pit. And it wasn't. That's on the level. It was slightly lower in the old days.
Tom Sheehan, a friend who I met through the Bruce connection, was a house photographer for his UK record company in 1975 and taking pictures of Bruce on the night.
Well, you were saying about the lighting being great. Myself and all my, you know, fellow photographers were thought it was pretty bad, actually. Well, because it was dramatic. Yeah, dramatic isn't good lighting. But, you know, total blackness and a shaft of blue light doesn't suggest. Although I managed to get a few.
Yeah, that's true. I was standing at the back, as you're looking at the stage on the right-hand side, and standing behind the...
Well, I was thinking you were sitting there, probably just round about here, at the end of this. And for the encores, I just ran forward and I was over there on the right.
And I wasn't here.
Where would you like it? On stage, obviously. Apart from
that. I'd be quite happy to where I am now, right in the middle. Yeah. And halfway back.
When you see six or seven guys on stage, all with virtuosis in what they do, all, you know, backing up, you know, with sympathy, you know, the friends and sympathy for the guys who's written the songs and all that, there's a total love amongst the whole bunch of them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. One of the reviewers said the band were awful. Was it the enemy or the sounds?
Yeah, I saw one of those, yeah.
Oh, I'll tell myself, it couldn't have been the same show.
I'd read those reviews as well. Tony Tyler from the NME wrote, "The band almost totally terrible, which is to say, adequate for many purposes, but not for backing the new, etc." Charles Shah Murray from the same magazine wrote of the night, "We were being handed the new sensation on a plate, but it was being rammed down our throats, plate and all. It was a case of, you will love him. So our response bordered on, the hell we will. To fulfil the hype, he'd have had to be fantastic. We sat there, arms folded, rolling our eyes, tapping our feet, thinking, go on then, be fantastic, impress us." Simon Frith, a British journalist who in 1975 was writing a column called Letter from Britain,
for American rock magazine Cream, was convinced he had witnessed something special that evening. But even he wrote, Springsteen broke the two basic rules of British rock. His band weren't very good on their instruments, and his act wasn't stylish. Pretty crummy in its technical range and subtlety. 30 years on, though, he's changed his mind.
When I look back at the review I wrote and notice that I wrote that the band was rubbish and wasn't very good, and I kind of think to myself, what on earth did I mean by that? And I suppose it was because one was used to a certain sort of virtuosity, and even a band like the Rolling Stones, which was not a kind of virtuoso prog rock band, nevertheless had an astonishingly tight an imaginative rhythm section, for example. Whereas I think Bruce Springsteen's band felt more like the sort of bunch of guys who'd be making forever music forever in a pub. And can do what they do very efficiently, but don't sort of go beyond that. There's no sort of sense of people who are technically could play anything. They could play what they played together because they've rehearsed it so much. So what was appealing about that was not their musicianship as such, although in retrospect they obviously were actually rather good musicians, but more a sense of a band who kind of liked each other playing together. And there was that sense of affection, that sense of the enjoyment that they were all having being with each other and having this opportunity, which came across very much. Interestingly, I think that kind of tied in with what in Britain became a very different sort of notion, which was punk, which was this notion that you don't have to be very good at anything to be a great popular musician. What matters is a certain sort of commitment.
Commitment is not something Bruce could easily be accused of lacking. I've often thought about the period in Bruce's life that coincided with Hammersmith 75 and heard about the hype and the enormous pressure on his shoulders. Bruce played another gig at Hammersmith the following Monday, which many say was even better. But the combination of the two performances were enough to cement his reputation as a true rock and roll star. Melody Maker journalist Michael Watts was there when Bruce walked off the Hammersmith stage that first night.
I think he felt let down, and I think he felt he'd let himself down. He was quite dejected. I think you have to appreciate that here is somebody who lived and died by his performance. He got so much out of being a performer and out of those 3 hours on stage. It's a cliche, but it's what he genuinely lived for. And I think he didn't step on that stage feeling good about being in England and about everything that was happening to him in his life and about being in Britain. There comes a point for every artist when you've got to play outside your own country, your own native country, to be considered commercially to have cracked it. I guess his management would certainly think that we need to get him to Europe. I do believe that it was a very important gig for him, a very big turning point for him.
It was the first time Bruce and the band had played in the UK. The first time the British fans, who had recognised Bruce's brilliance early on, were getting to see the magic, live, up close and personal.
How many years are we now? 33 years later? Still talking about it?
Oh, yeah.
It's vivid in my mind that night.
What makes you sort of think, wish I was there?
I just think that run of songs, really, like, beginning with Thunder Road, the kind of the way he looked in that particular period.
The great thing about here is being able to say you were here. I think that's the great thing when everything else is said and done. Were you at Hammersmith?
Yeah, I was at Hammersmith. Changed my life.
Yeah.
That night changed my life, yeah, absolutely. I started expecting something different from music. I saw what was possible, I saw what people could do with the stage, how people could work an audience.
Yeah.
And so my whole concept, my whole sort of perception of music just changed.
Dave Marsh is possibly the world's leading expert on Bruce Springsteen. He's known him and followed his career since 1973 and has written 4 books about him.
Do you think there's a chance if he'd have done a bad show, as we know it didn't turn out to be a bad show, only in the band or Bruce's mind. If it had been a terrible show, could there have been any dire consequences or...
I don't know. I've never seen him do a really bad show.
No.
I have been seeing the guy since 1973. If there's a crucial moment for him, he is going to find a way to rise to it and surpass his own everyday standard. I have never seen him falter when the pressure's on. You're in a situation. People have expectations of who you are. They aren't who you think you are. And therefore, you didn't have a good time that night. You may have done a great show, but for you, it was awful because it was like people had a bunch of expectations that not only could you not meet, you didn't want to meet in your own head. You didn't want to be the guy that was on... It wasn't so much you didn't want to be the guy who was on those flyers. you didn't want to be the guy who would allow those flyers to be printed in the first place.
The thing I've got, talking to these people and having met Bruce myself, is that Bruce isn't that guy. He's just an ordinary bloke, the sort you can imagine sharing a beer with, and ultimately a guy who gives his all and does something special every time he performs.
He did like an acoustic, well, sorry, piano version for you.
Yeah.
That wasn't what people did in encores in those days.
No.
They came out and they left their big song to the last.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was just a full band, you know, blowout for the encores. I remember when they walked, I think from there they walked across. I remember the audience giving Clarence a phenomenal. And I'd never seen that, and like a main act, that any other band get the same sort of applause as the main guy.
Yeah.
But my last thought was him, front of the stage, beaming face. The hat had flown off by then, you know? And just big smile on his face. I thought to myself, the connection between the band and the audience, it was like that, as opposed to band here, audience here. You used to read about the fact that he wasn't happy with that night. Mm. I used to think to myself, just have another listen.
Remember how I poured salt on your tongue and hung just a wreath. And the band, they played the homecoming theme as I caressed your cheek.
At the end of my day, 35 years back in time, down 10th Avenue, across the back streets and heading for Thunder Road, my journey has reached the end of the track. I feel privileged to have talked to the people who were there on the night and who, like me, have been there many nights since.
That was a fantastic night. I just was dazed. I walked out in a daze. I was with this guy. I couldn't speak to him. He was talking to me. I was like, yeah. Because I've never seen anything like it in my life.
For me, Bruce's songs have always been about ordinary people embracing life, trying to find meaning in the struggles of their everyday existence. And I certainly felt the spirit of Bruce was with us at Hammersmith as I walked away, having made new friends from the gig that I wished I could have been at.
That's a cracker,
last number.
And on that?
Yeah.
That's rubbish, I think.
It's great.
Yeah, I don't like it.
Oh, yeah.
That's brilliant.
Oh, it's brilliant, the way you've done that.
It's dead sharp, though, the hat and his face.
Yeah.
The light in his face. Pretty sharp. We should know, we're fans.
We continued swapping Bruce stories and looking at photos from the gig at a pub just round the corner from the Hammersmith Odeon. It was as close to an after party as we could get 35 years later.
It's fantastic.
And that's just right at the end where they come together to sing the last bit.
That's right,
yeah. The last word has to go to HP Source rep Pete Harris, who was at the actual after party, getting, as Pete would say, pretty tonto with one of his heroes. Now I really wish I could have been there.
We had a party afterwards. They'd made the foyer of the Hammersmith Odeon into a basketball pitch, and I'm not sure Bruce was too enamoured with all this sort of stuff, and they even had nets there. But we were sort of clowning around and didn't take it all very seriously. But the party was kind of party I never went to, and I think people were probably making contacts. I remember Johnny Walker being there, and he was pretty nice, and we met him, and he made some joking complaints on the Radio 1 the next day that he'd been to this show and enjoyed it and went to the party, and no one got a look in with Bruce because he was with his mates. We thought that was pretty funny too, and so did the boys back home, who were laughing. The last thing I remember was being outside on the road leaning against some limo with Bruce muttering, "I'm with my main man," and thinking that was pretty cool.
It's a town full of losers, and I'm pulling out of you the way. Oh, oh, on the road.
I'm Damon Gough, and you've been listening to Wish You Were There, an all-out production for BBC Radio 2, online, on digital, and on FM.